Dzień dobry Państwu. Nowy podcast Nowej Konfederacji nagrywamy w Double Tree Hotel w Warszawie, gdzie mam okazję rozmawiać z niezwykłym gościem. Profesor Hugh White, profesor studiów strategicznych w Centrum Studiów Strategicznych i Obrony Australijskiego Uniwersytetu w Canberrze. Jeden z najwybitniejszych, jak się mówi, strategów współczesnego świata. Był też zastępcą sekretarza do spraw strategii i wywiadu w australijskim Departamencie Obrony. Jest naszym gościem. Good morning, Professor. Thank you very much for accepting our invitation to an interview.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Przełączę się teraz na język angielski. I think we'll begin with your essay from 2017. In your essay, Without America, you have formulated a very strong statement that in the new bipolar order, where two poles are America and China, America is bound to lose and China will win. After 2 years, do you still support this statement? And if so, what are the arguments for this?
Well, yes, I do. I think I'm focusing here particularly on East Asia, on the region that flows from Japan down to Australia, down the Western Pacific coast. And in that region, where it seems to me that the United States and China are competing most intensely, it does seem to me that China has most of the advantages. It has a lot of power and it has a lot of resolve. I think if we look at the power side of the equation first, China's economy is now already bigger than America's. It's continuing to grow faster than America's. The Australian government estimates that by 2030, China's economy will be almost double the size of America's in purchasing power parity terms. That alone gives China a huge advantage in strategic weight. But also China's military capabilities are developing in ways that mean that even though it doesn't equal America, it's not an equivalent power to America militarily in the global scene. In Asia, where they're competing, where their competition is most intense, China is now able to impose a very significant cost on America, to make it much harder for America to project power by sea with the aircraft carriers and the Marine Corps. And I therefore think that America can no longer expect a low-cost, cheap, easy victory in a war with China. Now, together, that means that the cost to America of sustaining its strong leadership role in Asia, which has been so central to Asia's security for so long, the cost to America of maintaining that, now that China is resolved to try and exclude it, are very high. And my basic argument is that the costs to America are now so high that they're too high for America to be willing to bear. Now, of course, the officials in Washington all say that they're determined to push back against China. But I don't think the American people are. And I'm not even sure their political leaders are. I don't think Donald Trump's really committed to it. I don't think the Democrats are really committed to it. And from what we've seen in elections of the last few years, I don't think the American people are committed to it. And if that's the case, then I think in the long term, China will win.
Yes, but there are a lot of counter-arguments against your statement about the growing power of China. Some experts say that China is a paper dragon, that the American technological supremacy is overwhelming, that there are many countries in the region which won't let China dominate, for example, Japan, India, last but not least, there were many challenges who tried to defeat USA, USSR, Germany, and they didn't succeed. Why should it be different this time?
Yes, no, really, really important points. And you're right, many people say that China's not really that serious a challenger and it's not going to be very hard for the United States to push back. And as you say, they point to the fact that a lot of countries have tried to challenge the United States before and they've never succeeded. And that's true. But they're overlooking one thing about China. And that is that, well, two things perhaps. The first is that China's economy really is bigger than America's. There are lots of people who say that the Chinese economy is a bit of a paper tiger. I don't believe that's right. People have been saying now for 30 years that China's economic growth is somehow illusionary. That no one can go to China today, and not just to Beijing or Shanghai, but you go to one of the smaller cities. The city I visit sometimes in China called Changsha, and most people haven't heard of it. It's only the 19th biggest city in China. It's got a population of 7 million people. and you go to Changsha, and it's like New York.
Mm.
You know, it's huge and bustling. China, you know, we in the West find it hard to recognize China's actual achievement, and we tend to kind of resent it.
Mm.
But we've just got to go with the facts. The fact is that China has managed to drive its own industrial revolution, really. That's what China's done in the years since Deng Xiaoping's rise to power in 1979. China has achieved its industrial revolution. And I think we will never get China right if we don't recognize that it has become and will remain the world's biggest economy. And that gives it a huge foundation of national power. And that's the difference between the challenge that China poses to America and the challenge that America's faced in the past. For example, the Soviet Union, which was in many ways the most formidable strategic adversary the United States ever faced, at the height of its power, the Soviet Union's economy was never more than half the size of America's. Today, China's economy is larger than America's, and by 2030, according to the Australian government's estimates, and the Australian government's very pro-US, according to the Australian government's estimates, by 2030, in just a little over a decade from now, China's economy will be almost twice the size of America's. And that, I think, is really something is very hard to deny. That's the basic fact. And so that's why China poses a different kind of challenge to any of the challenges we've faced before. Now, that doesn't mean that America is in decline. I don't think it is. America will remain a very strong, very powerful country, but it's not going to have the kind of unchallengeable preponderance globally in the economic sphere, or for that matter, in the technological sphere, that we expected in the past. I mean, I think you mentioned the technology issue, and it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
China, of course, started a long way behind the United States technologically.
That's the point.
The United States remains, of course, a very technologically innovative country. But I think we'd make a big mistake if we believe that America is the only country that can innovate technologically. We have already seen China making very big steps towards the forefront of developments in key technological areas like artificial intelligence, like quantum computing. At a more practical level, the big question about 5G networks, I think it's generally accepted that the Chinese 5G system, the Huawei system, is a better system than the American system. We look at the uptake of consumer electronics in China, for example, the way in which Chinese platforms like WeChat are performing functions that equivalent platforms in the West don't achieve. I think we would be very complacent and very mistaken to assume that the Chinese system cannot generate genuine and sustained and very impressive technological innovation. And so for all of those reasons, I think, you know, we'd make a big mistake in underestimating China. Strategic history is full of examples of countries underestimating their rivals. It's much more common to underestimate your rival than overestimate your rival. And and I think we should be very careful not to underestimate China's power. The other very important point you mentioned is the attitude of other countries in Asia. And as you said, there have been a lot of countries in Asia who would be very uncomfortable with the idea of China becoming the dominant power. And that's true, of course, but I don't think we should assume that those countries will necessarily be able or willing to effectively resist China's ambitions for regional primacy in East Asia. I'll mention India first. India, of course, is a very significant country in itself. It's behind China so far, but it has a huge population, immense reservoirs of talent, and I think it's very likely that India will grow and grow faster and approach China, and eventually, I think, long after I'm dead, but eventually will overtake China itself to become the biggest country in the world, the biggest economy in the world, as its population overtakes China. And I think it's very clear that well before the middle of the century, China and India will be the world's two biggest economies. And you know, for that reason, I think India is going to be a very formidable competitor to China. But the question is, will it be a competitor in East Asia? You'll notice I've said throughout our interview that I think China will be the dominant power in East Asia. I don't think it'll be the dominant power in Asia as a whole, because I think India will be very committed to building and preserving and defending its own sphere of influence in South Asia and in the Indian Ocean. And I think China would fight, even though I think China's going to be a very powerful country, I think it would be very hard for China to really challenge India in the Indian Ocean and South Asia. Likewise, I think it'd be very, very hard for India to challenge China in East Asia and the Western Pacific. So rather than India, I think, you know, sort of counterbalancing China in East Asia, I think what we'll end up with is two spheres of influence in Asia.
What about Japan?
Well, Japan is a different case because Japan, of course, very significant country, very good friend of Australia's, very significant partner to Australia. But the reality is that Japan's economy by about 2030 will be something like 1/6 or 1/7 the size of China's. Mm-hmm. It will be an important country and a powerful country, but much less powerful than China. I don't think Japan is going to be strong enough by itself to stand up to China, and I don't think other countries like India are going to be willing to support Japan. The other thing to register, you know, there's lots of countries in Southeast Asia, for example, and there's Australia. But the fact is, for all of us, in fact, all of those countries, none of us, we all worry about China's growing power. None of us want to live under the shadow of China's power. None of us want to see our national choices constrained by Chinese influence. And we all would love the United States to stay engaged in Asia. I mean, I've been very clear with you that I'm pessimistic about America's long-term future in Asia. But that's not because I don't want it to be there. I would love America to remain the dominant power in Asia. It's been very good for Asia, very good for Australia. It would be the best outcome. I just don't think it's, you know, I just don't think it's realistic to expect it to happen. So, and if you look at other countries in Asia, they're in a somewhat similar position. They'd all like America to stay engaged in Asia to balance China's power. But none of them are willing to sacrifice their relationship with China in order to support the United States in a conflict or a strategic contest with China, because none of them are sufficiently confident that America will really be there for them. So I mentioned Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong's speech in Singapore earlier this year. That's really the message that he was conveying. He was saying to Americans, we do want you to stay engaged in Asia to balance China's power, but we don't want you to do it on the basis of you trying to dominate China, because we don't think you're going to succeed. And in failing, you'll divide Asia and run a very serious risk of strategic confrontation or even conflict. So we want America to stay engaged in Asia as a balancing power, treating China as an equal. Now, I agree. I think that's the right message for us to send to the United States. So I don't think when America looks to its friends and allies in Asia, even I might say to Australia, which is very close to America emotionally and historically,
like Poland.
Well, exactly. But you know, we've been an ally of the United States in some ways. You could say, well, certainly since the Second World War, but in some ways you could say going right back to the late 19th, early 20th century. And it's, you know, it's a very, very emotional bond we have with the United States. But even Australia is not prepared to declare China a strategic rival. So our Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was in Washington visiting President Donald Trump just a couple of weeks ago. It was a very warm visit, big state dinner and so on. And Scott Morrison went out of his way to express support for American positions. But on the key question, does Australia see China as a strategic rival? His answer is no. We talk about America's our ally, China is our strategic partner, we call it. We don't call China an ally, but we don't describe it as a strategic adversary either. So the point I think Americans are starting to understand is that Asia is not following them into the strategic contest with China that people like Vice President Pence are seeking to declare.
Yes, and one last question. In the China Choice 6 years ago, you stated that the way of maintaining peace in Asia is something like a concert of powers, like
right.
in
the
19th century.
Yes.
But it requires sharing powers.
Yes.
How would it look like, and is it likely that Donald Trump or Xi Jinping will share their powers?
Thank you. Yes, very, very interesting question. The argument I developed in that book, The China Choice, was aimed at exploring the question, if the US and China are going to be strategic rivals, if we're moving away from the old era where China accepted American leadership in Asia, which was the era we all loved, we're moving away from that. What's the least bad outcome the best outcome would be for China to continue to accept American leadership, but I don't think that's going to happen. So in a different era, and it seemed to me there's only three alternatives. One is that the US withdraws from Asia. The second is that the US and China continue to compete with an increasing interest of conflict, which I think would be very serious and terribly dangerous. And the third is that they do a deal, a kind of an understanding. So I tried to look at how America and China might share power in Asia. And I looked for historical analogies, and of course the concert of Europe was the great example of the way in which the great powers in Europe found a way to live together and get on. And the good news of the concert of Europe is that for 100 years, roughly speaking, from 1815 through to 1914, Europe was mostly at peace. The bad news, of course, was that some countries, and Poland in particular, suffered as a result of the deals that the great powers did between themselves. And so, you know, it's like everything in international relations, it's a complex story. But it did seem to me that if the US and China could find a way to treat one another as equals and use some of the kind of practices and ideas and expectations which had framed the concert of Europe, then that could provide a peaceful way forward for them to remain, for America to remain present in Asia and accommodate China's growing power. And I still think it would be the best outcome available to us. But I must say, I was never very optimistic that it could occur. I never argued in the China choice that I thought it would happen. I just thought it should happen. And I thought it could happen. And I suppose I'd still say that it could happen. But I'm much less optimistic now even than I was when I published the book in 2012. Because I think now, compared to where the world was in 2012, I think America is weaker and China is stronger. And so I think it's harder for the two sides to reach an agreement because America is less able to impose a deal on China, and China has less reason to accept a deal with the United States. And so although I still think it's a good idea, I think it's the kind of idea that Singapore's Prime Minister was arguing for in his big speech in June. I think it's the sort of approach Australia should be taking. But I think it's very unlikely to occur, and it's partly because, you know, to negotiate that kind of deal, if we look back again at the concert of Europe, you know, it was negotiated by giant figures like, you know, the Duke of Wellington and Metternich. You know, these were, you know, very, very skilled statesmen indeed. I don't think Donald Trump is in that class.
Well, it's sad, but still, I think we can finish by wishing each other that in the future we will listen to this great concert.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Podcast sfinansowano przez Narodowy Instytut Wolności Centrum Rozwoju Społeczeństwa Obywatelskiego ze środków Programu Rozwoju Organizacji Obywatelskich na lata 2018-2030.